Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
Well, he's been on the job now for about a week. Tim DeRuyter is the new defensive coordinator at the University of Oregon, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to let football fans and interested parties across the state on a variety of affiliates get to know him a little bit. Tim DeRuyter joining us now. Where are you right now, Coach?
I am physically in my office here on the fourth floor overlooking our fields and got a great view up here.
Give us an idea, because, like, you know, you're moving in. Is the place just empty with a desk and whatever? Or set the scene for us a little bit. Be our correspondent on the scene.
Okay, well, there's a few binders on the desk and some notebooks, some things that I brought from my last place that trying to go through tape and convert some language and go through our game tape and with the staff and try to get them to understand the direction we're going to be going in. And at the same time, we're trying to finish up, obviously, with recruiting National Signing Day today, getting our final couple guys, and also trying to, you know, keep those relationships going with next year's class because recruiting never stops. And also trying to get to know our guys, even though whenever I see them, they all got masks on, and trying to get relationships going with those guys. So it's been a pretty full day. Been here, I think it was day 10 or so now. But very, very busy trying to get to know our guys, our recruits, and get the staff on the same page as far as the direction we're going to be going.
Tim DeRuyter, defensive coordinator at Oregon, our guest. You played your college ball at Air Force. You were an outside linebacker. Did you know at that time defense would be your thing and coaching would be in your future, or was there some other kind of aspiration?
It was really kind of a bit of a pipe dream of mine growing up. As I grew up in Southern California, my dad was an immigrant from Holland. He had never played football. He was a son of a dairy farmer. My dad worked for my grandfather before he set him up with a drive-in dairy. So I think he assumed I was going to go on to school and, you know, go to work for him. But, you know, I liked football growing up. And they'd ask me, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, well, I want to play in the National Football League and then be a football coach. And they kind of laughed at me and said, no, you're too smart for that. You need to be a doctor or a lawyer or something. And, you know, I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to do it, but I also had pretty good grades. I was recruited by Ivy League schools, and I wanted to go to a place with the highest degree of academics as long as they had a Division I football program. And Air Force was my best option at the time. And going there, I thought I was going to be a pilot and fly. But still in the back of the mind, I thought, you know, hey, I want to be a ball coach. And the head coach at the time, Fisher DeBerry, asked me and a couple other guys to be graduate assistants. And, of course, I did that as one of the first years of my active duty service commitment. You have a five-year commitment as a second lieutenant. I was there in 1985 when we were 12-1 that year. We beat Notre Dame for the fourth year in a row and beat Texas in the Bluebonnet Bowl to go 12-1. And it just kind of inspired me that, yeah, coaching matters. I'd love to do this. But I never really thought it was going to be an attainable goal until about 3 years later I got a call from Coach DeBerry, and there was a military coaching slot available. And for the last 4 years of my active duty service time, he brought me back to the academy as a captain to coach there. And it's been a fun road. I was out of coaching after my initial 4 years at the academy. I was in medical sales, and then one of my coaches from Air Force called me and offered me the job to get back into it as the defense coordinator at Ohio University. And since 1995, I've been doing it. So it's been kind of a crazy ride. Obviously not the typical ride for college coaches, but been very, very blessed.
One time I was covering a bowl game and Air Force was playing in it, and Fisher DeBerry was the head coach. And at the news conference, I went up to put my recorder on the table, and I looked at Fisher DeBerry's watch. And I noticed that his watch was set 10 minutes fast. And I knew in that instant that Air Force had had the opposition right where it wanted him. What did you learn at Air Force that had nothing really to do with football that you still carry with you today?
Well, I think one of the biggest things, and it does have something to do with football, but not in particular, is that when you put a group of men through a shared common experience and make them strain together, that the magnitude of what you can do is so much magnified by guys leaning on each other and trusting each other that you can do unbelievable things that the normal sum of the parts don't seem to add up. You know, and I think our military exemplifies that. You know, when the Russians were our adversaries, they had lots more, weaponry and numbers of troops. We didn't care. We were going to beat them, with ingenuity and with people. You look at the players of the Air Force Academy, and, we never had the highest rated recruits, but we found ways to beat people that, by all rights, we weren't supposed to beat. And it's just that spirit and that positiveness that comes from guys leaning on each other and trusting each other and knowing that no matter what you set yourself out to do, you can do it if you've got a group of people all pulling the same direction.
Tim DeRuiter, our guest, Oregon's defensive coordinator. You come from Cal. How much of what we saw at Cal was Tim DeRuiter? How much was an amalgam of, Wilcox and others? And what can we expect? Will it look like Cal's defense at Oregon, or is it going to be a derivative of that with Tim DeRuiter's autonomy on it?
Well, it was certainly an amalgam of what Coach Wilcox had done before and what he wanted, at Cal, and some of the things that I had done at other places. And coming here, there'll be another evolution. I think the last couple of years, Oregon's done a really nice job on defense, but there's some things that I think we can simplify. There's some things that we can do from a sky standpoint. That can, magnify the talents that we have on this campus. And I want to have a simple system where our guys will be able to learn it, communicate it, and not think about it. That way they can play as fast as what we recruit and we train them to. And Coach Feld does a fantastic job with his staff of getting our guys from 4- and 5-star levels to where they're elite level guys. And coaches can slow them down if we don't simplify things enough where they can maximize that speed and still play fast without thinking. I mean, you can take a 4.5 guy and make him a 4.8 40 guy in a hurry if you're making him think too much. And we're going to try like heck not to do that.
It's interesting because I've had conversations with coordinators over the years about how terminology and calling the defense has changed. How much different is it now with sort of how the defense is called on the field, because you've got a lot of substituting going on offense and offenses that want to play fast?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the big things that I was able to do being with Coach Wilcox was learn a terminology system that really simplified things. And two things, it eased our ability to teach guys so that they can learn multiple concepts. And even young guys can learn it and be effective in the system. And then you hit the nail on the head with all these tempo offenses. You've got to be able to signal so that guys can get lined up and play in a hurry. Earlier in my career, as you derive different defenses, you may have, a front call, an adjustment, a movement, a twist call, a coverage call, and then a check adjustment for 2 or 3 things. So you're signaling 5 or 6 things. Well, while you guys are looking on the sideline for the signal, they're snapping the ball. So we've gotten rid of that system and gone to a much simpler system for guys to immediately get the call, get lined up, and play.
Tim DeRuiter, our guest, the Ducks defensive coordinator. I ask offensive coaches, I say, if I can give you one guy that is just a star on your offense, they'll generally pick a quarterback or a left tackle or something like that. From a defensive coordinator standpoint, I can give you one guy. What position is he playing?
He's probably playing our edge. Those guys can really affect a football game in all phases. you know, in the run game. They're going to do a great job of setting edges, being disruptive, knocking people back. And that's what our outside edge rushers are going to have to do. The next thing they're going to have to do is rush the passer. And when you got elite pass rush guys like we do in KT and others, those guys can affect a game. I mean, you go back to the, I think it was the 2015 Super Bowl, you know, a guy named Von Miller as an edge defender was the Super Bowl MVP because of how he affected the game. And in this defense, absolutely, those are going to be the guys that are going to have the opportunities to do it. But you've got to have corners who can cover on the outside. You've got to have, you know, guys up front who can dent the front and knock guys back. You got to have inside linebackers who can read flow and make tackles. So, you know, they all have to be able to do it, but I think the edge guys are really set up to be productive in this defense when it's being run right.
I figure after, you know, this becomes official, even though you are familiar with some of Oregon's personnel, you recruited some of these guys, you probably start watching film. How good can Kayvon Thibodeau be? How good can Noah Sewell be in your defense?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, Kayvon, to start with, I don't know that I've seen anybody since Von Miller play the way he does. He's extremely explosive off an edge. He can do a fantastic job of playing on a tight end, playing on tackles, does a great job of setting an edge, being able to have really good hand placement, get off and you know, violently get off to go make a tackle. Not many guys have that explosibility to do it in both aspects. There's some guys that are really good run defenders or really good, you know, pass rushers. I think he does a fantastic job of doing both, and we're going to try to put him in positions where he's going to continue to have those opportunities to affect a game in terrific ways. Noah is a very different player. Noah is a freak. You know, for a guy who's 260-plus pounds, to run like he does, to be able to diagnose and take great angles to the ball, and then when he gets there, the punch that he has, the leverage and violent hands that he plays with, he can do such a great job of erasing things that offenses try to do just by his speed and his angles that he takes the ball.
It's going to be fun to see that. And, you know, as you know, a lot of coaches will say, you know, you get out the back of the napkin at a coaching convention and you start scheming up offense against defense. In the end, you want to have the best possible players that you can have. You walk through the door at Oregon. Have you ever coached talent on this level? And I know you've had Von Miller and individuals, but the collection of talent on defense, is there a comparison maybe from Texas A&M?
Yeah, that's probably the closest, you know, because we had Von, we had DeMontre Moore, who should have been a first-round pick as the other outside linebacker. You know, we had Tony Gerard Eddy, who played for the 49ers for a while, Cordell Judy, Justin Harris. I mean, we had a fairly talented group there, but I think this group here is, you know, from watching them on tape, just as talented, and I look forward to seeing if we can't make them even better than that group.
You mentioned your dad earlier, and you know, I know that I've talked to you about this off air and wrote the story about it, but when you were 13, 14 years old, your dad got shot in the parking lot of a bank. How did that affect you? How does that affect your family? How did that change things?
Well, you know, it really makes you examine where you are in life. You know, you're 13 years old, you're at a CYU, you know, eighth grade basketball game. You know, life was awesome for me. You know, I never had a care in the world. You know, I was one of eight kids. We were all happy. And then I was number two of the eight. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're told your dad's shot and we don't know if he's going to survive. And so it was quite a gut check, you know, to, about a week later, you know, finally go to the hospital and be able to see him and all the tubes hanging out of him and, you know, where he was laid up for a pretty good bit and, you know, beat up pretty good. It was, you know, a deal where you check your whole card and, hey, what's life all about? And, you know, we became much, much closer, I believe, as a family through that, because you start to realize that life is so short and you better take advantage of the times you have.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think sometimes, you know, look, your dad got out of the business that he was in. He shifted gears and bought a sign company, and it really affects, you know, the, you know, I'm glad and grateful that he survived that. But I, you know, I can't imagine as a family going through that and how much strength you had to have in mom's role in that, as a glue person at a time like that. Mom had to be incredibly strong.
Oh, she absolutely was. And we were blessed. You know, I think I told you I'm a, you know, Catholic school kid, 12 years, and we were at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Long Beach, California, and in the community really rallied around my mom and our family during that time, and, you know, bringing meals over, you know, because we had eight kids. You know, my mom was at the hospital all the time, especially early on. It was really neat to see the entire, you know, parish community wrap their arms around us and help us through that.
Coach, you know, I know that you get boots on the ground and you immediately start meeting with players and teams and looking at personnel and trying to develop relationships, but there's a family element here. You know, how will you conduct the move? Will you be going back to Southern California? Are you here for good? Is your wife selling the house and then everybody moves? What's that? What's the personal element of this?
Well, you know, I'm very, very blessed that Kara and I have been married now going on 34 years. I believe it is. Yeah, 34 years this year. It's funny. My wife rolls her eyes when I say this, but it's absolutely true. There's only two types of wives in coaching. There's great wives and ex-wives. And I'm very, very blessed that I've got a great wife. And she's been through this now, you know, quite a few times. And it's a little bit easier now that, you know, Kara and I are at home. Our kids are out of the home. They're living in Texas right now. And so it's just us having to pack up the house. We decided to rent while we were in Berkeley. It's a little bit of a challenge housing-wise in the Bay Area. So that part will be easy, but she's kind of used to having to have me go and then her pack up the house, at least get it ready for the movers to get it moving. She was out here last weekend. She loves Eugene. She's so excited to be coming here because, you know, in our moves, we've, you know, been in big cities like the Bay Area, but she really appreciates the College Stations of this world, you know, the communities that are smaller that really revolve around the university. And she wants to get in, you know, involved in the community here, and just the whole vibe of game day, that everybody in town knows it's game day, and the way that our community here in Eugene supports, you know, the Ducks from an outsider perspective, been so impressive. She came a couple years ago when we played against you know, the Justin Herbert senior team, and she and my sister-in-law and brother-in-law came to the game, and they were just, you know, awestruck by, you know, how intense the fans were and just the whole community and scene here. So she's anxious to get here and get going with it.
Before I cut you loose, I've heard a lot of coaches who interview with Mario Cristobal say, man, that is like a gauntlet. He interviews forever. Is it really that different than other interviews? I mean, this is literally, I was looking at your resume. This is the 10th different move for you. You've had multiple jobs like at Air Force and A&M, where in Navy, where you shifted jobs. But this is the 10th move. You've done some interviewing, too.
Well, I have. And yeah, this has been different. The others were one or two, and it was usually, you know, a done deal. This was much more of a process. I think Coach is extremely diligent in going through everything he can to make sure he feels totally 100% this is the right guy. We're doing that right now with the defensive back position that we're interviewing for now. And you know, the first few calls were a little bit more get to know me personally, you know, kind of personal philosophy and then defensive philosophy. And then we started involving, you know, the staff in. And I think I told you before, you know, he was very good about it. I told him up front, I said, Coach, you know, if I'm in a different league or something, I'd be more than happy to talk to you about detail of our scheme. But you know, I can't do that in good faith. You know, we're going to play you next year if I'm still at Cal. And he understood that and respected it, I believe. And, you know, I think I talked to him enough about how we did things, and he had the tape, of course, to see what we do, that he felt confident that I could come in here and, you know, help us get to the goals we want to get to.
Coach, I appreciate it. Thanks for giving us your time, and we'll talk to you down the way.
Oh, absolutely. Good talking to you again, and go Ducks.
Tim DeRuiter, Oregon Ducks defensive coordinator. If you missed any of that, grab a podcast, and if you loved it, share it with a friend or somebody that would appreciate it. Leave it here. You got the BFT statewide. Really good stuff from Tim DeRuiter. I think as you listen to him, I think you hear substance there. That's what I heard. I also, I didn't get too in the weeds about, you know, how he plans to disguise defenses. And I'm mostly interested in, you know, does a coordinator who takes this job, who was at Cal and before that at Fresno State as the head coach, does he come through the door and look at Kayvon Thibodeau and Noah Sewell and go, okay, I have what I need here, among other guys, to be successful? It's not going to be a personnel issue. So, you know, how, you know, it's the Jimmys and the Joes versus the X's and the O's, so to speak. How will Tim DeRuiter, who has a good reputation as a defensive play caller, how will he be in this personnel grouping, or the personnel that the Oregon Ducks have now? How will he, how much success will he have? It'll be fun to see what he
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.